Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Elliot Reichart, host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Professor Vincent Adams about her new book, Glyphosate and the Swirl, an agro-industrial chemical on the move. Glyphosate and the Swirl is part of a broader trend in research that is developing new methods and techniques to study our increasingly polluted and toxic world. Professor Vincent Adams is Professor of Anthropology, History, and Social Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Her recent book takes glyphosate as a case study and follows this chemical as it moves from the past to the present, from the lab to the dinner table, from outside our bodies to within our cells, to grapple with what it is to live in such an entangled world. Professor Vincent Adams, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Professor Adams, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm a medical anthropologist. How far back do you want me to go?
Just like how you got interested in MedAnthro, how it is that you ended up on, all the way back.
I'll try to be brief. That's really hard for me, but I'll try. I started out as an undergraduate at Brown University, and I was actually kind of a science person, and I got into the neurosciences, which were brand new at that time at the university, the study of neuroscience, of the sort of cultural, so semiotics was emerging and the neurosciences were emerging together. And I was kind of interested in both of them. And I was in a neuropharmacology class and was fascinated with this problem of cognition and culture and how the brain processes things in culturally specific ways. And then I got into the second year of that course of study, or the second class, which was the neuropharmacology class. And I realized that a lot of the work in that field involved research on live animals. And I decided I didn't want to do that. So I wrote a paper for that class on the problem of aphasia and cultural differences. And that got me involved with a professor at Brown named Lucille Newman, who was a medical anthropologist. And I spent more time with her and I realized that she was doing something that I really was drawn to, and then spent the rest of my undergraduate time. The rest of my undergraduate time taking all the medical anthropology courses that she offered and all the medical sociology courses that were offered on campus there and at the graduate level, in the first year graduate level, I got into a few of those. And then wrote my senior thesis on, believe it or not, acupuncture, because that in the neuropharmacology class, I started doing some, on a second paper, I started looking at the neuropharmacological mechanisms of acupuncture and realized that the biomedical scientists were using all the wrong measures for understanding what was happening with acupuncture, and they were reducing it down to the simplistic argument about endorphins. And I just fell into this world of Chinese medicine and thought, oh my God, this is so much more interesting. So then I started graduate school with an interest in Asian medicines. And because I had found out about medical anthropology, I applied to then the only program that offered a PhD in medical anthropology, which was at Berkeley and UCSF, a joint program, which is where I am now. And then started my graduate work looking at one very interesting Asian medical system, which was Tibetan medicine. And at the time, you could only go to study Tibetan medicine on the periphery of Tibet. So I was working in Nepal for a number of years. And then over time, I did a lot of projects on Nepal. And, you know, once you immerse yourself in that world, you realize medicine is a small piece of this much larger story about what's happening in place and time. But yet it's also a really great window onto some of the big predicaments of the places where we work. And so I sort of stayed on that path and wrote a couple of books on Nepal and medicine, and then had an opportunity to go start working in Tibet. So I spent a fair amount of time looking at women's health in Tibet and the politics of Tibet, basically. And even though I've never published the book on that, I've had a manuscript that's in process for 20 years. I have just spent a lot of time working on the politics of health in that space, and how science gets used in different projects to advance social and political interests and also conceal them, as the case may be. And then at some point in my work in Tibet, I started really getting worried about whether I could publish anything, because the things that I wanted to talk about were things that could potentially get all of my colleagues there in trouble. And at that point in time, a new opportunity opened up to me, because one of my colleagues, Gay Becker, had died suddenly and was in the midst of being awarded a grant to work in New Orleans on post-Katrina recovery and the process of aging. And the NIH program officer came to me and asked me if I would take over the project, because she was my colleague. And it was complete departure for me. But because I was really worried about the work in Tibet, I thought maybe I'll just do something different for a while, and then got into the post-disaster world and found that to be a really interesting story about the other side of the politics of, well, in this case, disaster. In Tibet, it was of occupation. And that opened me up to just like pursuing a lot of different projects that, you know, that had to do with interrogating capitalism in new ways, interrogating the predicaments that we've gotten into with climate change, and in that space also around toxicity. And that then freed me up to do some more interesting critical analysis of the world of global health in terms of evidence and science, and did the metrics book. And then this project I got to by way of having completed the work on metrics, you know, and I had always had these strong interests ever since the beginning, really, of how evidence and how science in particular is used in projects of social management, concealment, political, you know, resistance and political oppression. And so I met this woman who was actually my neighbor, and we started to take a lot of walks, and she was an integrative pediatrician. And so I was really interested in her work. And the more she talked to me, the more I realized that there was a really interesting story that needed to be told about the way medicine had overlooked food and how the food system in our country had become a disaster in its own right, and how especially agrochemical food production was probably needing a lot more scrutiny and critique. And so I thought at one point, well, I'd like to write a book about her work in medicine and the problem of agrochemical food industries. And I told her that, and she said, oh, I've been wanting to write a book for years. And so I realized, well, I have to co-author a book with her then first, as a sort of ethical thing to do. And so we spent a few years mapping out a book that looked at the this sort of perfect storm where in her world, as she said, kids were sicker than they had been. A generation of sick kids that were sicker than any generation before them. And she attributed it mostly to the food they were eating. And that was part of the perfect storm. The other part was the way our science had been managed by the sciences of toxicity had been managed by industrial capitalism in ways that made it very fraught in terms of its truth quotients. And the problem of the politics of denial around chemical harm. And so a lot of these things all came together in the book where we talked about, the book's called What's Making Our Children Sick, which was a title given to us by the publisher, the trade press publisher, which I'm still not very happy with, but you did it anyway. And it was a really great project and I really loved it. But the whole time we were working on it, there were these nagging problems that I was having with the way my co-author really wanted to tell a straight story about the way science could prove the harm from glyphosate. And that there was so much more to the story that I thought needed to be told about glyphosate being a sort of model system for how we've gotten into a bad situation with being able to rely on science to get us out of the trouble of chemical harm. And that's what led to the book Glyphosate in the Swirl.
So it sounds like there was some challenges with having to create a simple, straightforward narrative about chemical harm. I was wondering if you could explain what the swirl is and how the swirl concept can be used to sort of address that challenge.
Great question. I can describe the swirl. I'm not sure I can say that it will help us solve the problem. I think my sense of it is that it describes the situation that we're in more than it does resolve it. The swirl was what I came upon after first wading into the territory of how getting traction and accountability on chemical harm in our world was so impossible. And I mean that in the world, in the global sense, in a global way. And, you know, it's heightened visibility of that issue in the U.S. But the way in which no matter how much traction you might get on the science, it seemed to just disappear in terms of actually gaining traction on doing anything about it. And in the case of glyphosate, the swirl sort of first defines the predicament we've gotten into around knowledge of the chemical and its potential toxicity, in that it swirls in different consensus-driven ways into different spaces at different times, but it never settles. And it moves and it looks like it has solidity and it doesn't. The sort of model system that I'm thinking of is, or that I use in the book, is the murmuration of starlings that move through the sky and cluster and then break up and then form other clusters. But the swirl also describes for me, I found this through doing the Bigger Brook project, the way that the chemical lives in our world in swirl-like formations, where it clusters and concentrates in certain places, in soils, in plants, in atmospheres, and then also in bodies, and causes different impacts depending on how much it's concentrated in all those different places. But it doesn't produce uniform, linear-like cause-effect maps for us because it's always moving and never settling. And so the third place where I explore this is in the bodies of people. And I got access to the bodies of children through my co-author on the last book to look at the way in clinical practice she was using glyphosate to anchor her theories about how foods were toxic and creating a wide variety of chronic health disorders for kids that appeared on the skin, in brains, in organs, in guts. And her argument was that the way the chemical glyphosate moved through the body, it could produce all these different effects. So in some places, and with some scientists, it was working in the liver to cause harm. In other people, it was causing harm in the guts. And so the whole system was being thrown off in a swirl-like kind of way. But it also describes the way she was able to sort of forge a theory of a harm that she would take. I also think it describes the way activism works with chemical harm, where people grab hold of certain kinds of scientific threads and then use those to push political agendas forward and make headway with certain legislative processes and, you know, lose ground in other areas. And so I feel like the swirl is not a metaphor. It's a description of how we live with chemicals. And as we live in this way with chemicals and are potentially harmed by some of these chemicals, we also have to sort of think about our science in ways that work in step with that swirl-like fashion. And the big thing with the science and the knowledge being swirl-like, I think if there's a critique in it, there's a, you know, underlying critique of academic capitalism that has made it for a situation in which, because the investments of science have been so tethered to different industries and capitalist agendas, that pulls us in ways away from our ability to trust the science, in ways that are oppositional to the way that other fields of research are now really pushing for, you know, using science to land political gains.
Thank you. Why is it important to study glyphosate ethnographically or from the perspective of an anthropologist rather than, say, as a scientist? What sort of additional benefit is there from approaching it in the way that you have?
Let's see. You know, I felt like, well, I'm influenced by a lot of great people in the approach that I took in this book. Anat Singh was a big figure in my mind in the way that she shifted the ethnographic gaze from, you know, human-centered relationships to things and the way those things guide us into different spaces. And that breaks up the, you know, sort of the plantation. It breaks up our methodologies in ways that force us to deal with all these different systems that are at play. I also was very influenced by Murphy's work on chemical harm and the idea that we should be following the chemical, and Mel Chen's work. And then Nick Shapiro's great work on formaldehyde was super influential for me. So this idea that if we follow the chemical, we end up in different places in the stories we're telling about the nature of chemical harm, the causes and the effects and the possible avenues for redress and addressing those harms. My thinking was that I wanted to sit with glyphosate for a little while. And first I was interested in how all these different people were using glyphosate to make certain claims. But then as I started to look more into glyphosate, I thought it had an interesting story to tell of its own and its own ontological, let's say, multiplicity in the ways that it was discovered, in the ways that it, because it was a multiple thing that had multiple different purposes, like it was patented for multiple different things historically, that all opened up the possibility for new spaces that it could move into. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to follow the chemical through its journeys in all of these different places and see what that does for the story that we want to tell about, that I wanted to tell about glyphosate's habitations in our world.
Wonderful. Thank you. So how is it that glyphosate became so closely associated with genetically engineered foods?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. You know, every time I have a story, I have a conversation with anybody about GMOs, the first thing they say is, well, you know, we want things like golden rice. And, you know, this is no different from agriculture and from, you know, culling herds, and it's the same old thing. But what most people don't know, and what I didn't know before I started this project over 10 years ago, is that most of the genetically modified foods were designed for two main purposes. 99% of GMOs are designed to withstand the spraying of glyphosate, which is Roundup, which is the patented product, you know, product patented by Monsanto as an herbicide. And the second thing that they're modified for is the presence, the insertion of a toxin called BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a pesticide which kills any, if a bug eats any part of a plant that has BT in it, it will die. And it dies through a kind of septicemia where it punches holes in the lining of the gut and then the animal dies. So the basic food crops that are 99% of the market for GMOs are soy, corn, canola, cotton alfalfa, and blanking on the fifth one, on the sixth one, the food crop, sugar beets. And those crops are designed so that they withstand the spraying of glyphosate or Roundup, and they kill insects that haven't got resistance to the BT. And that system of agriculture was designed so that, in theory, it was to produce higher yield, make crops more prolific by not being able, not having to compete with weeds and not having to compete with bugs. But, it's raped. It's basically turned the agricultural world into a situation where farmers are now triply dependent on these companies for the seed crops, because you can't reproduce the seed crops. It's illegal. It's a patent violation. You have to have fertilizer for the soil because the soils are being killed by these by the spraying of Roundup and other toxic chemicals. And the pesticides that are used to go with these crops. So there's a triple dependency. And so farmers are having to be subsidized by, the government all over in the US in particular, in order to sustain themselves because it's so expensive to farm like this. Anyway, that's the system we have. And it was designed, and then the food system is organized around making use of these basic food crops, sugar beets, so sugar, corn products, canola oil products, and soy products. Those are the basic commodity crops that use GMOs in the U.S. and have worldwide presence and are, it's a really fraught system. So anyway, that's where the GMO connection is with glyphosate. And that explains those crops, and that agricultural system explains why there's so much glyphosate in the world. However, keep in mind, Roundup is marketed directly to the public. And so it is a very powerful weed killer. And so it's also sold to people who want to use it in parks and in recreational areas, in playgrounds, in their backyards, on sidewalks. It's everywhere.
Yes. And most people seem to have, as you mentioned in your book, small amounts of it in their urine when tested.
Right. So there've been a couple of studies done on urinalysis. A guy named Paul Mills down at UC San Diego did these studies where they were looking at they found old samples of urine, and then they compared them with contemporary. And actually, it shows up in the urine of a lot of Americans and in the breast milk of breastfeeding women.
Yeah. In the US. So it's sort of everywhere.
It is.
So you describe glyphosate as having ontological multiplicity. Could you explain for our listeners what that means and its origin story relates to that?
Yeah, I was starting to talk about this earlier, because when it was created, and there's controversy over, the provenance of this chemical to begin with, which is all in the book. But, it was originally discovered as a metal chelator, and it was patented as a metal chelator and by a chemical company that probably got bought by another chemical company, which got bought by Monsanto at some point. But perhaps Monsanto's own story is more accurate, where one of their scientists was actually experimenting on different chelators to try to create a weed killer and came up with the formula on his own, with the chemical on his own. But when it was identified as also a weed killer, it got patented as a weed killer and not just as a metal chelator. So it had double potencies right there. But it also has a patent on it for being an antimicrobial. which is, of course, one of the reasons that people are worried about it being in human systems, because it would kill microbes in the gut. Okay, so there are all these ways in which the chemical mutates and changes depending on the context it's in and what it's doing in those worlds. And so that's a kind of multiplicity right there. But then I follow that through in the book to the ways that it does that in different spaces as well, whether we're talking about agriculture, whether we're talking about bodies, or whether we're talking about legislative debate, you know, testimonials being given in front of legislative bodies.
What is it about ontological multiplicity that makes it very hard to determine whether glyphosate is safe or causes harm or causes damage?
Well, one of the things, I trace this in the book in a couple of different ways. The fact that it operates as a chemical in some context and as a biologically active entity in other contexts. And this is where I go into the debate about regulating the chemical. You can see how that shift, that multiplicity enables it to shift from being regulated in one way in some spaces and other ways in other spaces. So because it's a chemical, it can be patented. As a biological thing, it can't be patented because it's a chemical. So its biological effects make it so the FDA, the USDA, and the EPA all have different ways of thinking about the potential harms of this chemical, depending on how they're reading what it is, either as a chemically active or a biologically active thing. And so that enables it to slip through the cracks of regulation pretty fully, I would say. And you have to read the details Wonderful. In the book.
Yes.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Why is it so hard to make sense of chronic illnesses in terms of what causes them? And how did Michelle come to understand that the chronic illnesses that she saw in her pediatric clinic might be related to glyphosate?
Yeah, so Michelle Perro, my co-author from the first book, who I write about also in this book, who I worked with to get many of the ethnographic materials on the clinical presence of glyphosate. And her theory is that glyphosate's, she could probably do a better job of this than I can, but the basic idea is that in her world, lots of different things are happening in the body that look like a symptom array of harms or of malfunctioning systems, let's say. And so in some people, for a variety of reasons that may have to do with their ability to methylate toxicants that get in their body, or their inability to do that, that may have to do with other problems they may have having to do with allergic or immune system responses. All of those things end up producing pathways that show symptoms in different ways, but may be related to an underlying fundamental problem with the way their nutrition and the food they put in their bodies is being processed in their bodies and is impacting the basic foundations of digestion and nutritional, you know, accumulation of nutritional content from materials. So glyphosate has a big impact, she argues, for a variety of reasons. One is it is an antimicrobial and it breaks down the microbiome of the gut. And once you have a gut that is where the lining is has become leaky, and it can become leaky through dysbiosis, which is the over presence of certain harmful bacteria and under presence of healthy bacteria. The tight junctures of the microvilli get kept open, and a lot of bad chemicals get into the bloodstream. So once you have this system of a bad digestion from the food that we're eating, from the toxics in the food that we're eating, and you have chemicals more present in the body, you get immune system reactions that are sort of low-grade chronic response. So you have like inflammation, chronic inflammation. But because the body is not getting the nutrition it needs, it doesn't have a good immune response. It has a faulty immune response. So you have this low-grade chronic irritation, inflammation going on all the time, poor nutrition, and you ultimately end up with a lot of digestive problems. So, you know, diarrhea and sort of straight digestive system malfunctions. Then you also have immune system reactions that range from autoimmune overreactions to just sort of sensitivity responses that are triggered by this inflammation state all the time. So things like eczema, asthma, ulcerative colitis, you know, a series of this is all her thinking about it. I'm not a doctor, so I am not equipped to be able to evaluate whether it's right or not. But her theory is that these things all stem from basic flaws in the way that our foods are being produced, the way that they're impacting our digestive system, and then our systemic responses to that that show up in a lot of different chronic ailments, even psychiatric problems, because, of course, a lot of the chemicals end up in the brain. And my interest in her theories is not so much to say, oh, she's right. She may be right. She may not be right. But I like the way that her approach shows us how glyphosate becomes a sort of glue for her theories, cohering a theory of chronic malfunction, multiple malfunctions, and chronic disorders that are on the rise, actually, among a lot of populations. In relation to food.
Thank you. That's perhaps the traditional response to these theories might be to say, well, we should hand this complexity and these difficult questions to science, and let a scientific consensus emerge, you know, do some experiments about this. But for a variety of reasons, it seems quite hard to achieve the scientific consensus around glyphosate. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what is a scientific consensus, and what about glyphosate makes it quite challenging to achieve that?
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, there's a whole couple of chapters on this in the book, and that's one of the reasons, again, that I thought glyphosate was a really important story. I think that we, especially in the times we live in of, you know, anthropogenic climate change, where we really want to rely on the science. And I'm a scientific believer. I am not opposed to science, but I think that what glyphosate shows us is something that's common to a lot of different fields, especially around chemical harm, but is particularly pronounced in this case, of how the history of producing knowledge, scientific knowledge, through the pass-through of industrial support for studies of chemicals has made it really hard to decipher where the truth is. So in other words, academic capitalism has gotten in the way, especially around agrochemical research, because almost all of it has been funded by industry. It's gotten in the way of us being able to really trust the science And I'm not a person who believes that just because it's funded by industry, it's lying. But I think that there is an argument to be made about it muddying the waters. So we have a growing group of scientists in the world who have been looking at the potential harm of glyphosate and publishing on that. And they believe that we are going to get to a new consensus. They're sort of, you know, Kuhnian paradigm shift people who believe that eventually there'll be so much data, we'll just have a different view of the harm of glyphosate. And, you know, there has been some traction on that in the last few years where the International Agency for Research on Cancer, based in France, came out with a ruling that it was a probable carcinogen, and that has been picked up by the WHO. And of course, that's being contested by other groups in Europe and other groups of scientists. And the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine in the U.S. produced a report which claims that it's perfectly safe. So there, the consensus in the U.S. is that glyphosate is not harmful. And then there's a more minor consensus in the agro-industrial world that says glyphosate is way less harmful than other pesticides that could be used and herbicides that could be used. And so why are people complaining about this? I mean, and it's true. It is less harmful probably than a lot of others. But so the, in the world, that, you know, of the different worlds that glyphosate sits in, there are a lot of people who do want scientists to just solve this problem and to come up with the better research. And all throughout all the documentation on this, you have these claims about the consensus being this and the consensus being that. And what I came to decide is that, one, the consensus isn't really reliable. It's not reliable anymore in this case. And also, there's no such thing as a consensus. It's a constantly on the move. It's shifting, and it depends on where you locate yourself within what I call the swirl, that you would claim a consensus. And it's partly because of the way glyphosate has moved in these different places that we have multiple different versions of the consensus operating at once and against one another, in direct contradiction to one another. Whether you take the idea that they're looking at different things to heart, or whether you take the idea that they're looking at the same things, but they have different investments in what the outcome is. So it's a constantly unsettled problem.
Thank you. Because there might be questions of whether it's a chemical or a biological agent as well.
That also comes to play in it, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the way consensuses are formed through organizations like the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine is that they have this idea that you go and look at everything, and then you come to some conclusions based on the best possible evidence of comparing and contrasting. But these are really difficult projects to compare and contrast the kinds of data and the materials. Like in some instances, they're looking at the weight of livestock to see whether they've had a health impact. And other people are looking at organ systems and you know, molecular and biomechanics or, you know, proteomics in those systems. And they come to different conclusions. And then the committees have to like compare those two conclusions and decide where the predominance of evidence lays, right? And the question of where the science is produced and who's paid for it are seldom asked. Even in the organizations like the NASEM committee, they don't have, they haven't just brought in industry scientists to make these decisions, but those people aren't always looking at where the data came from and where the publications were published and how they were published and who did the work and what their goals were in the research to evaluate the quality of the work either way. And it's basically too hard for anyone to do all of that. I mean, even science studies scholars can't do all of that. It's like, you know, the Latourian, you know, footnoting, you know, black boxing process happens all the way down the line, and it becomes too hard to actually make a case about it.
Oh, that's very interesting. What is academic capitalism, and what's its origins in the modern university, research university in the States?
Oh, I'm not going to be able to give the great details about this, but basically academic capitalism is this idea that there is no firewall between the industries that are funding the science in the academy, in, you know, the university, and the university's own research practices, which assume and presume that they have freedom of intellectual property and they have freedom of, you know, and that they're being honest about the work they're doing. So in the case, I don't know about the history overall. It's a very complicated question because for every different science, there's probably a different history. But in the case of glyphosate, it started, I tell the story from the start of Monsanto's hiring of a guy named Howard Schneiderman, who was a insect developmental biologist from UC Irvine in 1975. And he actually documented in his own autobiography the painstaking effort that he went through to convince his academic counterparts to not be afraid of collaborating with Monsanto on these development and research projects. And there were ethical concerns, and there were concerns about, you know, credit, where credit would be given, fears about, you know, industry scientists not being fully able to disclose. And these are debates that are continuing in every field of science where industry is funding science today. In the pharmaceutical industry, it's really big. But that was sort of the beginning of it for the story of glyphosate, was with this guy who was able to make these seamless connections between the academy and the industry and get a whole bunch of researchers in different institutions ultimately across the country where agro-industries were paying for whole fields and departments of agro-sciences to come into existence. And no one really questions, I mean, some people question it, but it's not really considered a problem, a conflict of interest anymore. And so there are some people who, like Lisa Barrow, who have been able to document how there's a bias in publications when industry funding is behind research. But I actually, you know, I wouldn't call it a bias as if the truth lay somewhere else. I would just call it, you know, a continued set of interests that create a swirl of knowledge that accomplishes certain other things. But it means that there's also, sometimes there can be real conflict for people who are outside of those circles who are finding different outcomes. So yeah, academic capitalism is, you know, it's here to stay. We're not getting away from it, but it's made a mess of things, I would say, in terms of being able to really decipher how much we can rely on the science.
Because it's not able, one's not able to really separate the science from the industrial processes the science is designed for.
Well, it's like Isabel Stenger says, you know, it's not like it's false science. It's not like it's corrupt science. It is intentional science and its intentions are very clear. That is to gain, you know, industry outcomes that are of interest to those funding sources. I talk about her language for it in the book, but it's sort of like, you know, there's no outside of the box question that could be asked in industry science that would necessarily put the whole thing at jeopardy in the first place.
Wonderful. Thank you. Could you talk about the hearing in California in 2017 that you attended regarding Proposition 65, and sort of the ways in which glyphosate tripped up, as you said, even the most heart-wrenching commitments to hold chemical companies accountable.
Yeah, so this was the California EPA, the Office, OEHHA, the Office of Environmental Health and Human... OEHHA is the local EPA branch of it's California's EPA basically committee, and they held after this news about glyphosate being potentially carcinogenic, which means that it's been tested in animals, it's shown to be carcinogenic, but in humans hasn't been tested for that. So that's what makes it probable, a category B carcinogen. After that news broke, the California EPA held a hearing where they were looking at all the evidence of whether to add glyphosate to the list of toxic chemicals that needed to have warning labels on all the products. It's the Toxics Clean Air and Water or something Act. Anyway, I can't remember. But they also had open public testimony. And of course, I knew a lot of the people who were there, and I went there with them and watched the legislative process, got involved in some of that as, you know, a participant observer. And what was interesting is that the EPA, the OEHHA actually did decide to agree, they agreed with the sort of WHO's new stance on it being a probable carcinogen, and that would have meant that they would have had to put warning labels on products. It wasn't going to get rid of the products from the shelves. It wasn't going to stop anybody from using it. It just meant that they would have to put a warning label on. But even then, the Monsanto Corporation actually did file the lawsuit against the state for to prevent that from happening. And that was successful. And so, you know, there's a huge ag industry that doesn't want to change any of this in California in particular. And ag, you know, our legislative body is super beholden to the agricultural sector. So, and the agricultural lobbyists. So that was unsuccessful. But, you know, in the book, it's funny, I'm not saying it was total failure. I mean, I think what I was trying to do in that chapter of the book was talk about the way glyphosate has become an agent of an ally in the fight, because even though the outcome was not legislatively, it didn't hold. It was a huge gain for the lobbying efforts and the public publicity on it and the recognition of the public of the need. And I mean, you know, even health people now talk about glyphosate. I mean, I can't tell you, when I started working on this project, if I mentioned glyphosate, everyone would roll their eyes, especially if I put it in the context of GMOs. And now whenever I mention glyphosate to any of my health colleagues, they go, oh yeah, that's so dangerous. You know, it's like, it really is getting out there and people are now worried about it.
There's a concern. There's a, people are caring about it, one might say.
The swirl has moved in a new, you know, part of a different swirl.
This new constellation has emerged of these different connections. And so now it's bubbling around the potential harms of glyphosate and all the different.
Exactly. But, you know, there's a big leap from, you know, that to when you think about actual, you know, things that could be done. Like, I'm a firm believer that we should, you know, really rethink our agricultural industrial systems, and we need to think about permaculture and regenerative agriculture. These are huge potential solutions to not just the food problem, but to the climate problem, you know. But, you know, it would take a huge amount of heavy lifting and investment on the part of, you know, government subsidies to shift from one kind of agriculture to the other. A huge change in the way people think about food scarcity and distribution systems and resources and all of that. But, you know,
it's worth.
I'm not, yeah,
it's worth trying to get there.
I'm not sure this world's going to get us there, but
perhaps not. And then, in the final, so now that glyphosate appears to be this actor in its own right, with some kind of agency to sort of become an ally, you also come upon a notion that might surprise some of the listeners, which is that you describe glyphosate as possibly being an agent of care. In what sense do you mean care, and how is it that a chemical can care?
Right. That's a good provocative question that I end the book on at myself. I'm throwing it out there as a possibility, but I was influenced by Maria Puig de la Blacasa's work on soil and the idea that if we're thinking about ontology and humans not being the center and most important character in our analysis, and thinking about, she talks about soil being the thing that is the beginning and end of the story. So humans play a role in soil health, but they're not the sort of end point of soil. Soil isn't a resource for human survival. Humans are an agent in soil survival. And so I was influenced by that, and also by Anna Marie Mole's work in ontology, and was just trying to pointing to this possibility of thinking of glyphosate does a lot of consolidating of political interest and a lot of consolidating of evidence of harm. And even the case of it being a carcinogen has done this huge thing, as I just said, to move forward the sort of landing of a swirl with a lot of high concentration of action and movement and potential in a certain way around chemical harm. So glyphosate kind of stands for a lot of other things that we could talk about in the agrochemical industrial food production system or in the world of chemical harm and exposure that helps people to sort of, or that helps us to think about its own survival as the thing that we're enabling, which is may or may not be good for humans. So what I mean by it being an agent of care is that it's bringing us along, and it's not like we're benefiting from it, but it's if we're thinking about care as this thing where the system is what we're operating in, and it's an ecosystem where multiple species interact and multiple things have to survive together. This is what we're producing, and this is, you know, it's not a great story, but it is in some sense doing some work for people to change the way they think about survival in the world.
Wonderful. And then towards the end of the book, you describe how the agrochemical industry might be responding to this. You quote Hugh Grant, who makes an announcement with the idea that in the future, the next generation of modified agricultural provide actual medicines for you. It'll provide chemicals inside you to help fight cancer or process fats. And eventually it'll intensify the value added, as they say, of the corn that they will be selling. What does that tell us about the swirl and sort of the next phase of it that it might be emerging?
Right. I mean, I think it will be another swirl, but that is the direction that things are headed from, especially now that Bayer Corporation owns Monsanto. It's an irony that, as I say in the book, you know, we could think of the profits of Monsanto as being a source of potential chronic harm. And then the company that owns it also double dips and makes money on the medicines that it's producing to take care of those. I mean, think of all the medicines out there for digestive health problems. I mean, it's crazy, right? Everyone's got eczema. Everyone's got all these gut issues. And, you know, so you eat the food, get sick from it, and then you buy the second medicine from them to take care of the sickness. But that is... not exactly what he's talking about there. He's talking about the sort of promissory of genetically engineered food crops. You know, Monsanto's been right there, and those scientists that are now at Bayer have been right there in the middle of this world of making foods do the things that we want them to do to keep us healthy. And, you know, for many years, that was just based on the idea that you produced a ton of it at cheaply, and you know, there wasn't really much attention being paid to what the side effects of the pesticides and other things were. Now the shift is to work with the microbiome world to figure out how to make foods do healthy things for the microbiome. So putting, you know, first of all, they're having to do it from the soil because they know the soil's running out of microbes, and soils are being depleted all over the world. So they're trying to figure out how to make soils more nutritional and healthy. And they're on it. I mean, they're going to be doing this, and it may be great. Like, they may come up with great solutions. It hasn't been the pattern. The enhancements make up 1%, enhancements not being the sort of pesticide resistant, herbicide resistant, pesticide filled foods, but the sort of vitamin A, you know, putting vitamin A in golden rice and things like that, the enhancements that make it really healthy and more nutritious. I mean, they might be able to do some of that stuff. I was listening to a report the other day about cows and trying to reduce methane by creating some kind of engineering of the either plants or the cows that so that they would produce less methane in the air, which is a great, you know, possible future outcome. I'm super skeptical because I think companies always, like big companies like that, always have they want to have a win-win scenario where they're doing the right thing and making a lot of money at it. But I think that there's a lot of blindness around what the right things could possibly be when it means like losing profit. So, you know, all I know is the way that they've been ferociously resisting the attacks on glyphosate or the idea that glyphosate could be dangerous is doesn't bode well for a future of really socially responsible companies like that.
Wonderful. Well, Vincent, we've taken up a lot of your time, I can imagine, today. And we would like to ask you the final question, the traditional question of the New Books Network, which is, what are you working on next?
So technically, I'm going to retire. I'm on my way to retirement. And so I'm working on that. But no, I've got a bunch of projects. I've got an old book on Tibet that I still want to publish, perhaps. I've got, you know, I'm working on other people's work. I'm working with my graduate students. I'm working with the book series, the Duke University Press Critical Global Health series. And you're talking about glyphosate with people, but I haven't got a second. Other than the Tibet back burner project, I haven't got another book in mind or research project that I'm doing right now. But thanks for asking.
Well, Vincent, I wish you a wonderful retirement, and it sounds like a really nice time to transition into that stage. Sorry. And I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and take care.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was fun.